You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
As part of International Women's Day 2024, we bring you this talk by Maxine Fuchsen, a Portland-based pediatric nurse and anti-Zionist Jew who has traveled to Gaza 3 times as a healthcare worker. This talk was given at Portland State University in February 2024.
My name is Maxine Fuchsen. I am a retired pediatric nurse practitioner, and that's really informed a lot of my work in healthcare for children, and a registered nurse. And I'm Jewish, and I'm opposed to Zionism. I'm anti-Zionist Jew, as we call ourselves. And I can explain more about that if there's questions or discussion. I think Dennis is going to talk about that a little bit, but it's part of what informs me for who I am. I'm active in Jewish Voice for Peace here in Portland, and nationally I'm on the Jewish Voice for Peace Health Advisory Council, and I'm also involved just the last few months with a new group that's really active called Healthcare Workers for Palestine. So those are kind of the places where I organize. And I wanted to start by just telling you a little story, because part of my work in healthcare is I've had the opportunity to travel and work in Gaza on 3 occasions. I was in Gaza in 2011, 2012, and 2014, so following past Israeli assaults, and saw the absolute horror and devastation. And one of the things I did while I was there was I worked at a lot of different clinics and hospitals as a nurse practitioner, and I was working for a number of days in one of the pediatric hospitals in Gaza City called Al-Rakizi Hospital. It no longer exists. It's been destroyed by Israeli bombings. But I was for a few days following and working with the nursing director, whose name is Imad, and helping him do some of the work. I was giving some in-services for the nurses, and we were developing a very nice relationship. It was a collegial, great relationship. And on about the third day I was at Al-Rakizi, we were having lunch together, and somehow in the conversation it came up that I was Jewish. It wasn't something I hid, but it hadn't come up before. And I could feel him recoil a little bit and get a little bit tense. And that afternoon, I felt like there was just a little difference in our relationship. And a little bit the ease and the comfort that had happened over the few days just wasn't quite there. And you know, he is a beautiful man. And he at one point said, "I need to ask you, what did you do?" And I think his thought was, why would I, as a Jew, be in Gaza? Why would I be working? He was, you know, suspicious, rightly so. Who was I? And I explained to him that, firstly, I just apologized. And I said, this is just, I imagine this is so, so hard. And I need you to know that there are Jews in the United States who don't support our government's policy around Israel, who don't support what Israel is doing, and in fact, who feel extremely committed to Palestine liberation, to the liberation and the human rights of Palestinians. And I think he was a little bit skeptical, but we worked together for the rest of the day, and at the end of the day, he said, "I think your husband's here in Gaza with you," and he was doing some other projects. He said, "Would you come to my house tonight for dinner? I need my children. I have 6 children. I need them to know you. I need them to meet you." And I was like, "Yeah, sure, I think so." So if you could go to the first slide. Oh, yeah, okay. So this is, we went to his house. These are 3 of his oldest daughters and me, and then the next slide is his family. This is Imad in the middle in the darker shirt, and many of his children by the end of the evening. So he lives in a very traditional Palestinian housing unit. It's a house where all the different layers of the family, different generations, the siblings live on multiple layers. By the end of that evening, there were 45 or 50 people, and it's one of the most memorable evenings of my life. And I don't tell you that because this is like a, oh, feel-good story. I tell you that because these are the faces of the people our tax dollars are bombing and killing. So I can tell you, Iman is alive. He's not in Gaza City. His hospital, his work, his heart has been destroyed. These are the people. These are the people. So just take a minute and take a look. Go ahead. And then this is a picture. I did a couple of different lectures in the nursing school. This is at Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. These are the nursing students. So this was 2014, so 9 years ago. They're all working nurses now. I have no idea how many are alive. And then the next one, if you want to go ahead, is the men. Many men in Gaza, in Palestine, are nurses. And again, I just feel like we have to look at these faces because, yeah, these are the people. Next picture. One of the things that Israel has been doing has been destroying centers of learning. And this is Islamic University. So this Islamic University, obviously this is an older picture. This was 2014 in the assault in Gaza. Prior to 2014, this building was bombed. And Al-Azhar University is just adjacent to Islamic University. This is where the medical school is, law school, school of philosophy, so much. There's not one university standing in Gaza. So I want to talk about health for a minute in Palestine, and then we'll segue into specifically Gaza. And the reason I want to do it is because I think that health gives a really important and good way to look in on apartheid, on settler colonialism, and currently on genocide. When you talk about health, when any of us talk about health in Gaza, or health in Palestine in general, we can't be looking at it from a just humanitarian lens, like, oh, this is a catastrophe of humanitarian proportions. Yes, that is the discussion we need to be having right now because of what's happening in Gaza. But it is part of the matrix of apartheid and settler colonialism. It is very much the fabric of the society that Israel has created. And that's why health is so important, because health is such a fundamental pillar of society. People cannot survive without a healthcare system. Israel knows that. That's why it targets the healthcare system. It has destroyed the healthcare system in Gaza. So it's a structural part of what's happening. And it's interesting because I think it's illustrated so well. I was doing a talk at Al-Shifa Hospital in 2014, and it was in service to the nurses. We were talking about concepts in public health. And in public health, there's the whole discussion about going upstream. So instead of just treating little components of an illness or components of a disease, you look upstream. What are the root causes of things? And so somebody raised their hand, one of the nurses, and said, so this health problem we're talking about, I think the occupation is the root cause. And it was all of us like, yes, that is the root cause. And that's so important to understand in health. So apartheid, again, it's characterized by the systematic oppression and violation of human rights with the intent of one racial group to maintain domination over another. The term medical apartheid has been used and refers to situations of pervasive segregation and discrimination in healthcare based upon race and characterized by stark inequities in healthcare accessibility, availability, acceptability, and quality. We certainly recognize it here in this country, and it's very recognizable in when you have a healthcare system that is so unequal is that you have a lot of health disparities. One population who is privileged, the other who does not have the privilege. So for example, Palestinian life expectancy is about 10 years less than that of Israeli Jews, including Jewish settlers who share the same land, the same air, the same water, sometimes the same water, as the Palestinians. 10 years less life expectancy. The infant mortality rates are 4 to 5 times as high among Palestinian infants as Israelis. Palestinian citizens of Israel, within 48 Israel, have a higher incidence of chronic illness. One example that is just so huge around health disparity and health apartheid was what happened when COVID vaccine came out. COVID vaccine came out, and Israel, as the occupying power, had the legal obligation to provide vaccine for Palestinians. And yet, the Israeli ordering of vaccines, distribution of vaccines, completely excluded 5 million Palestinians from getting vaccines. In the same piece of land on the West Bank, settlers were getting their vaccines, Palestinians weren't. And you know who the first people that got vaccines among the Palestinian population? It was Palestinian workers that were going into settlements to work. It wasn't to benefit the Palestinians, it was to benefit the fact that they needed them to work in the settlements. All of the factors in an apartheid society that impact life impact health. One's ability to have economic stability and a chance for a livelihood that's not stagnant, that has some sense of future and progress. The right to safe and stable housing, access to quality food, water, a clean, safe environment, educational opportunities, freedom of cultural and religious expression, and freedom of movement to be able to go where one needs to go for work, for pleasure, for families. So there's three factors that have been looked at that really show medical apartheid at work. One is the fact of a healthcare system being completely chronically underfunded. The Palestinian healthcare system, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and I'll talk about Gaza particularly, but chronically underfunded. Israel maintains control over the funding through money that's given to the Palestinian Authority, but always with the ultimate control when tax revenues are given out, when they're not given out. The Palestinian healthcare system is controlled by Israel. Chronically underfunded. Frequent attacks on healthcare systems and healthcare workers. Every single time Israel launches a military assault, whether it's in Gaza or in their maintenance of control on the West Bank, healthcare facilities and healthcare workers are targeted. I don't know if you read just a few weeks ago in Jenin, the hospital in Jenin was raided by the Israelis multiple times, but Israeli soldiers posed as doctors and patients and went in and destroyed part of that hospital. It's a feature of military control. And then the third factor of apartheid in healthcare is seen in restricting movements. Systems that restrict movements of patients affect their health. There are story after story of mothers who delivered babies at checkpoints because they couldn't get through the checkpoint to the hospital. So now what I want to do, that's in general. What I've just been talking about is the West Bank and Gaza. But I want to segue to Gaza because I think right now it's so important. And we've heard, and it is so true, that history did not start on October 7th. We just need to remember that, and I think that we've heard that really well. So some of the specifics of Gaza health. This is prior to October 7th, and I talked about the underfunded and under-resourced healthcare system. So Gaza has been under a siege for 17 years, imposed by Israel, occasionally allowing a little bit more in, usually keeping the Gaza Strip closed. In fact, the number of calories that people in Gaza needed to just avoid starvation and malnutrition, but not enough to really thrive, that was what was calculated as the amount of food to be allowed in by the Israelis. system, anything that's deemed dual purpose in terms of entering Gaza, supplies, medications, anything, if it's dual purpose, the Israelis are prevented from going in. So the hospitals in Gaza, the clinics, if you go and you work there, you feel like you've walked 25 years back, 30 years back in a healthcare system that has just been struggling to maintain itself under these conditions. Cement, construction material, don't forget the hospitals. Every assault, every few years when Israel assaults Gaza, the hospitals are targeted, so constantly needing to be rebuilt. We saw destroyed whole entire wings of hospitals. Can't be destroyed because they can't get the materials in. Batteries, electronic equipment, all kinds of things needed, computer parts for medical machinery, not allowed to come in. There was a period of time in Gaza you could not even get an x-ray because the components for radiology machines were not allowed. Medications, always at a very low, low level. Some of the health indicators in Gaza before October 7th that just don't make sense. The Gaza population is one of the most well-educated populations in the Middle East. There are so many people in Gaza with higher degrees, PhDs, masters, so many well-trained doctors. And yet it's a stagnant economy. Israel has control, it has maintained the control of what goes in, what comes out. So therefore, unemployment in Gaza, 50%. That's a health indicator. That is a determinant of health. As I mentioned, every military assault, healthcare workers have been targeted. One example was during the Great March of Return, which was the nonviolent march when Gazans protested along the border. 250 healthcare workers were injured, two killed, 35 ambulances were targeted by Israeli forces. There was no threat to Israel. This was all happening in Gaza. In the 2021 Israeli assault that lasted 11 days, 53 attacks by missiles on hospitals, clinics, and ambulances. 30 health facilities in Gaza damaged to the point of disrepair and not being able to be used. So those are just some examples. And there's so many, but time, can't do it all. And then the third that I mentioned, the right for mobility, the right to travel. Leaving Gaza for healthcare. If you have an under-resourced, poorly equipped healthcare system that cannot keep up, people need to leave Gaza to get treatment. Oncology treatment, cancer treatment in Gaza is very hard to get. Sophisticated imaging types of things, you can't get those kinds of tests in Gaza. If one wants to leave Gaza or needs to leave Gaza for treatment, you have to get approved by the Israeli military. You have to get a permit. There's study after study by the World Health Organization of permits denied, treatments delayed, which have impacted people's cancer treatments, heart treatments, people who died waiting to have their permits approved to leave Gaza and go to Israel. So those are kind of the situation where it was before October 7th. What we're seeing now in the past 140 days, tomorrow it's 140 days. It's not new as we've gone on. This is an occupation, an oppression that has gone on for decades. But right now we're at a crisis level. So I think it is appropriate to talk about humanitarian needs. We need to talk about the long run and what needs to happen, but right now we need to stop this genocide. So, informed by the Geneva Convention, which states that healthcare facilities must never be targeted. Healthcare workers are not targets. Ambulances, medics are not targets. The healthcare system destruction is just another genocidal act, as people cannot live without health. The International Court of Justice stated that the South African claims were so eloquent in pointing out all the times, all the ways that Israel is targeting and purposely destroying the healthcare system. Right now, we know this, the death count approaching approaching 30,000, with 12,000 being children. Most of the 75% of those injured and killed are civilians. 70,000 are wounded. 1.7 million, or 75% of Gaza's population, has been forcibly displaced, often numbers numerous times, and all down to the southern part of Gaza, as we know, to Rafah. People are living in the most horrific conditions. They're having to relocate into tents, living out on the streets. It's winter weather, it's raining, so people are living with raw sewage going right by where they're living, where children are playing. Diseases are rampant now. Infectious disease is the highest killer of children under two in Gaza. It's off the charts right now. Hundreds of people are sharing bathroom facilities. No showers. Starvation is at a crisis level. Just last week, UNICEF issued a report that 90% of Gaza's children under two and 95% of pregnant and breastfeeding women through Gaza are facing severe food poverty. We have a colleague, friend of mine, friend of many of ours here, who's in Gaza right now. She's with a medical group, and I just got a text from her this morning. I want to read it to you. I got it. Here we go. This is from Asma this morning. I just met with the journalist from Azad Press. The situation in North is devastating. There are 300,000 people who are stuck there. They have no food, no aid. They cut all the international aid for them, and people are literally starving. They're eating animals. That is, eating donkeys, dogs, cats. They led a couple of trucks to get in with flour, and then they threw the flour on the sand, and people are collecting it from the sand and eating it. So the situation in the North is devastating. If there's anything that can be done to bring this to Congress or to increase awareness like this, it's almost more important now than a ceasefire at this point, because people are starving to death and their children are starving. And if you could help them, we would all really appreciate that. Salam. Only 14 of Gaza's 36 hospitals are functioning. And if that varied, and if you've been following the news, you've probably seen the recent siege on Al-Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Specifically, there's a crisis on women's health care in Gaza. 180 women in Gaza give birth every day. It's happening under unsterile conditions. Women are giving birth on hospital floors, in corridors, outside. No anesthesia is needed. In the next month, it's estimated that 5,500 women will give birth, and of these, about 800 are expected to need some kind of higher medical intervention for a safe birth. It doesn't exist. That intervention does not exist. So let me just go to there. Yeah. I wanted to show you, because this is health, and this is so, so important. So if you look at the periphery of Gaza, because I wanted to show you where the restrictions are on fishing. Let's see. This is a section of Gaza. We're looking at this picture. We're standing. This was some houses that were demolished in an earlier invasion. Whoops. There. We're looking east. We're looking towards Israel. And if you see that area of land, kind of in front of where the big tall trees are at the top of the slide, and then there's a green sort of cultivated looking land. That's the border, that's Gaza, and it's the land on the eastern side of Gaza. It's the most arid area of Gaza. A lot of cultivation happens there. Animals are herded there. It's a very important agricultural area. So one of Israel's actions that's happening right now is they're extending inward. They're making Gaza smaller. So they've moved the border inward, and they're now bulldozing that whole stretch of land along the border. They're removing all of that very important agricultural land. And why I talk about that in health is because that's the source of so much of the vegetation, fruits, vegetables, very varied diet. So if you go ahead then, one more, oops. Yeah, so there we go, there's Gaza. This is a big, excuse me, an enlargement of the Mediterranean Sea. If you look, 20 nautical miles out is what the Oslo Accords gave permission to the Gaza fishing folks. It's never materialized. They've never gotten to go that far out. And that's important for deep sea fishing, because where people are mostly able to fish now is 3 to 6 nautical miles. Now, none. This is pre-October 7th. But before that, fish is a very important source of protein in the diet. And it was ample fish, except now all the inner waters are being fished out. So basically what Israel's doing, oh, and the other part, I think maybe Wael maybe mentioned this, but possibly not. The other thing that Israel is now doing is dividing Gaza in half from east to west. So basically a highway in the middle of Gaza, cutting the strip north to south. So now everybody's been forcibly relocated down into the south to Rafah. How are they ever going to get back to the north, which has been completely demolished? You've probably seen pictures. But when people want to have that chance to go back home, how will they do it? It's a fortified highway. I just really thought this essay was important. Okay, I'm just going to read it really quick. Though we have never known a free Palestine, no number of bombs can extinguish the inborn will to live in dignity. In this way, our resistance is, to quote Mahmoud Darwish, incurable. This is the heart of Israel's problem, not one of Palestinian savagery, but of Palestinian life. It is a scourge on the Zionist project. Our century-long refusal to disappear, it will remain a scourge so long as the state of Israel exists as a structure predicated on our death. The moment we face now is apocalyptic. The engines of destruction roaring at our gates and in our skies. Each moment is an atrocity. Genocide has begun. But Israel is mistaken if it believes this will be the final word. Palestine will live. So I'll end you with the last slide on, which is the sunset over the Mediterranean from the reaching Gaza. And I guess I'll just say responsibility, I think. Educating yourself. I think if the media is not telling the story, you can talk to any of us about what sites to be looking at. If you want, we can send reading this, whatever. I think the imperative right now is simple. We need a ceasefire. We need an immediate, permanent ceasefire now. And any way you can do that, talk about it wherever you are, groups, friends. Write letters to your congresspeople if you're into doing that sort of thing. Post on social media. That's the imperative. We just don't have time. This is every day a humanitarian process.
That was local Portland nurse Maxine Fuchsen speaking at Portland State University in February 2024.
You're listening to KBOO Radio. I'm Shay. Today, we're discussing a short film made by Portland-based filmmaker Laura DiTrapani. The film, titled Exquisite Corpse, is named for the children's game of the same name, where players take part in drawing different body parts on a folded piece of paper. Only at the end is the paper unfolded, revealing a collaborative creation between participants.
People can be very inventive in what they decide to draw on their section of the page, and this seemed to me at the time to be a very apt description for what my film was going to involve.
The film's narrative is based on a 20-year-old email correspondence between DiTrapani and Sujit Bhatt, a man from East India.
Email at that time, this would have been the late 90s, was a very new phenomena, and it was very unfamiliar to me. We didn't have emojis at that time yet so that we could get some clues as to what the emotional intent was behind those emails. So it was kind of difficult, but we had this astonishing correspondence that ranged from the mundane of how we live our lives daily to quite involved philosophical and cultural questions. He, of course, had the background of Buddhism, Hinduism. My background was in Western Christianity, I suppose one could say. And so it was a fascinating correspondence.
The film is animated, using a variety of styles, both 2D and 3D. These include more traditional animation styles, like shadow puppet and silhouette animation, to more contemporary techniques, like photo collage and time-lapse.